Hello and welcome to a special end-of-year edition of the GTR News Brief. It's December 2023 and I'm your host, Felix Thompson. Over the past 12 months, GTR's team of reporters has been covering a wide range of topics from across the trade and trade finance space. And today, I'm joined by my editorial colleagues to discuss some of these. Insurance-related disputes, the impact of Basel requirements on the trade finance sector, efforts to ban fossil fuel support within the OECD arrangement, and the demise of yet another digital trade consortia all feature in our 2023 review. We simply don't have enough time to delve into all the different news stories and developments we covered as a team in 2023, but my colleagues have each handpicked an article which captured our readers' attention and which they argue speak to wider trends shaping our industry. For listeners not familiar with the team, today I'm joined by senior reporters John Baskell and Eleanor Ragg, and we're also joined by my fellow reporters Jacob Atkins and Jenny Messenger. Thanks for joining me on the show, guys.
Hi, Felix.
Hi, Felix.
Hi, Felix.
Okay, so let's start with a major story from this year, which has been the disputes between insurance companies and commodity traders. Back in 2020, in the initial months of the COVID-19 crisis, there were a series of insolvencies in the commodities trading market involving the likes of Hin Leong, Phoenix Commodities, as well as Enroc. And 3 years on, the fallout from these collapses is still being felt in the market. John, you've been reporting regularly on the demise of Phoenix Commodities. Could you just give a bit of background to the case?
Yeah, of course. Thanks, Felix. So Phoenix was a commodities trader headquartered in Dubai. And as you mentioned, in the first few months of 2020, Phoenix collapsed. At the time, it emerged that Phoenix had lost something like $400 million on sort of failed currency hedging. But since then, we've got a bit more information, a bit more insight into what really happened there. So this particular story, this was based on information provided by the liquidators that were appointed to manage the insolvency at Phoenix. And what the liquidators found was that Phoenix had, within its kind of records of its trading systems, Phoenix had two different ledgers, ledgers basically of trades between companies that it was doing business with. Some companies appeared in both ledgers, but with different sort of counterparty codes. And what the liquidators concluded was that one of the ledgers appeared to be made up of invoices that didn't correspond to movements of underlying stock. They couldn't be identified in accounting records. And the conclusion the liquidators drew was that those transactions being recorded didn't actually relate to real trading activity.
And I mean, the documents you tracked down for the story related to a court case involving an insurer, Dubai Insurance Company, and a trader, Westford Trade Services. What is the dispute here exactly? I mean, what exactly are the two sides arguing?
Yeah, that's a good question, because the liquidators' reports haven't been made public. So this information comes out of the court case you're mentioning there. So Westford Trade Services, it was actually two Westford entities, one in Hong Kong, one in the UK. They were owed money by Phoenix at the time it collapsed. Phoenix submitted claims to its insurer, which was Dubai Insurance Company, to try and recoup those losses. But Dubai Insurance refused to pay out on the policy. So the insurers basically argued there's no evidence that the parties involved in those trades actually had title to the goods. They've sort of basically tried to argue that these were sort of sham transactions, that they only existed for financing purposes. And to support those claims, they've reproduced information from the liquidators. So that's how this comes about. But it's worth saying that obviously Westford is contesting that. And in its defense filings, Westford has said it had no knowledge of Phoenix's internal record keeping. It was unaware that Phoenix might have been using the same goods or the same trades to kind of raise financing from multiple different lenders. And from Westford's point of view, they argue they legitimately acquired the title to goods. They had the bills of lading associated with those trades. So from their perspective, everything was above board. And even if it was fraud by Phoenix, then it doesn't have any ramifications for Westwood's claim, they argue.
Okay, so this case is still very much rolling on. What's the latest in the case? I mean, has there been any development in the dispute in recent months?
So as we're recording this, we're in a situation where we've seen multiple defence filings from Dubai Insurance Company, but we haven't seen an updated claim from Westford. So things are a little bit imbalanced at the moment. But the latest we've reported is that the Dubai Insurance Company they have presented documents that they claim prove that the transactions Westford is claiming on could not have happened in reality. So the supplier, for example, there was a due diligence report on the supplier carried out commissioned by Westford, which found no business registration information, no website. They couldn't verify the address, couldn't verify the phone number. And then when the funds were due to this particular supplier, rather than transfer the funds, the insurer says that Westford reassigned a pre-existing receivable to that supplier. That receivable apparently originated from business with a company called Darren Tech, which appears to have ceased trading years ago, back in 2017. So that's the latest we've heard from the insurer, but it's worth bearing in mind we don't have a response to that yet from Westford. But more broadly, another important piece of background to this, I think, is we've just reported that another case also involving Westford has been concluded in Malaysia. So this was against a different insurer. This was against Archipelago Insurance. And there are a lot of parallels. So the insurer tried to argue that the transactions were fake. They presented documents which supposedly showed that the parties that were actually moving the goods were completely different to the ones involved in its claim. But the court found in favour of Westford. So the court, basically it said the evidence presented by Archipelago didn't prove sufficiently that the trades weren't real. The burden of proof is on the insurer to prove that it was fraud or that the transactions were shams, and they didn't manage to do that. So that's the latest on this case in the broader sense.
Fantastic. Well, cheers for that update, John. It certainly sounds like it'll be a story to watch going into 2024, this battle that's playing out between insurers and traders. And now turning towards you, Jenny. So you've been covering the export finance industry quite extensively over the past year, in particular efforts to slash the sector's exposure to fossil fuels. Can you just give us the latest in these efforts?
Yeah, so I think one of the most significant developments was a proposal backed by the UK, the EU and Canada to end export credits for oil and gas. And so this was brought to the table at the OECD meeting back in November and expands a prohibition that's already in place for coal. So back in 2015, the OECD brought in they agreed to limit financing based on CO2 emissions thresholds. And then in 2021, that turned into an outright ban on financing for new unabated coal-fired power plants. So this new proposal is pretty significant. Like if it, at the meeting in November, there were no decisions made, but if next year in Q2, when they meet again, it's still on the table. So there's scope, especially in the wake of COP28, for significant progress to be made.
Okay, so you've got this push going on within the OECD arrangement. And then, I mean, more recently, the COP28 climate summit was held in the UAE and the issue of public finance for fossil fuels invariably came up. Were there significant pledges made by ECAs at the conference? Can we expect to see major fossil fuel backers shift away from oil and gas as well as coal in the coming year?
Yeah, that's a good question. So another significant thing to come out of COP28 was Australia and Norway agreed to join the Clean Energy Transition Partnership. And so this was a pledge that was originally agreed back in 2021 at COP26. And this basically is an agreement to end international public financing for fossil fuels. It also includes a stipulation to drive multilateral negotiations at the OECD in the direction of the Paris Agreement. And so since Australia and Norway have joined, they really should, at the OECD's meeting next year, they should be also pushing for this proposal to end oil and gas financing.
Thanks, Jenny. Well, okay, so it sounds like there's momentum growing behind the shift to move away from fossil fuels within the export credit industry. But time will tell whether actual reforms will be implemented within the OECD. Now, turning towards Basel regulations, Jacob, this has been a story you've been covering and keeping a close eye on. Can you just talk us through what's been proposed in the UK and the EU with regards to Basel regulations?
So the UK and the EU have both put forward their proposals for how they're going to implement what is termed, has a few different names around the world, but generally in Europe, it's called Basel 3.1, which itself is formulated by the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision. And basically it governs, tries to minimize risk in the global banking sector and governs sort of capital requirements regulations globally. The EU's proposals were released quite a while ago now, back in 2021. And the European Commission proposed to several things relating to trade finance, but the main thing was to lift the credit conversion factor for off-balance sheet trade finance items to 50% from the 20% that they had been. That's for things like standby letters of credit, technical guarantees, warranties, etc. They also proposed ending, forcing banks to apply a 2.5-year maturity floor to those items as well, which is much longer than the regular maturity of a letter of credit, for example, which typically matures within a few months, not 2.5 years. And then the UK, earlier this year, so quite a bit later, released its proposals, which were pretty similar. It also proposed lifting the credit conversion factor for those kind of items to 50%, although self-liquidating those of credit would stay the same.
And what's the reaction been of the trade finance banks in the UK and in the EU?
It sparked a lot of negative reaction from trade finance banks in Europe and then subsequently in the UK. Basically saying, arguing that the Basel Committee's framework was based on old or just no data about the risk profile of trade finance. They argued that trade finance was a relatively low risk category and they shouldn't be required to put such a high capital, such large reserves of capital aside for those items. Their chief kind of lobbying argument was that it would also drive up costs for European companies because they would then in turn have to charge more for these kind of products, which would then, of course, those costs would filter out into the real economy because those companies would then have to charge their suppliers more, et cetera, et cetera. So that was, they have been the chief arguments against these reforms.
Jacob, do you mind if I ask? If we've already seen a scaling back of the availability of trade finance in quite a lot of areas. Trade finance gap is getting bigger. Is there a risk this will just push banks to focus on other areas of their business if it's no longer economical to provide trade finance?
Yes, that is definitely true. There's been an argument that banks might simply withdraw these products from sale or accept from their offering, or perhaps just only offer them to like very key customers and not SMEs because they simply won't be able to the margin will be so slim on them that the capital would be much better to be deployed elsewhere into areas that don't have such high capital requirements, for example. Also, interestingly, GTI held a roundtable in South Africa recently, and there's a lot of discussion there. Obviously, it's not affected really by EU or UK prudential regulation, but there was an argument that Basel's imposition of these capital requirements is also affecting the availability of trade finance there for similar reasons that banks just deploying capital in more profitable areas.
Okay, so it sounds like there's a lot of anxiety among European banks over proposals. But I understand some of their fears have been allayed. I mean, what's happening here?
Yeah, I mean, specifically for the EU, the lobbying campaign that I mentioned was essentially successful. There was a big campaign by the ICC and large European lenders like Santander and BNP Paribas. And they sort of managed to convince the Parliament, the Commission and the Council, which are the EU member states, that trade finance is a special case and it warrants a deviation from the Basel text. Because that's been the main bone of contention in the EU, is there's been very bitter opposition for any deviation from the Basel Committee's text from certain countries and regulators like the European Banking Authority. But European lawmakers decided that a deviation was warranted in this case. So the conversion factors will remain at 20% for those items I mentioned, and the maturity floor as well, the proposed maturity floor as well, is not going ahead. But for the UK, they're still analysing the feedback they've received. So we don't know yet what exactly they're going to do, whether they'll do what the Europeans do or something else. But they are releasing what they call their near final policy statement on it in the second quarter of 2024. So we should know then.
Fantastic. Thanks so much, Jacob. Now, we'd be remiss not to talk about trade digitalization efforts, which has been a topic that's come up again and again over the past few years. And Eleanor, you've covered this area extensively. Now, a GTR exclusive in late October revealed that digital trade finance consortium Contour was to shut down by the end of November after bank shareholders pulled funding. Eleanor, I mean, could you just explain what the story is here?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Felix. So, yeah, like you said, over the past kind of few years, significant column inches, mainly mine, have been dedicated to these kind of efforts around bringing trade into the digital age. But more recently, there's been a bit of a shift in that the stories that we've been covering now tend to be less about progress and more about the lack thereof. So just sort of casting our eyes back a little bit, you know, we've seen a whole host of these collaborative initiatives kind of be consigned to the history books. So, you know, TradeLens, Marco Polo Network, WeTrade, and also in most cases, the news of their downfall was broken by GTR. So Contour, as you mentioned, this blockchain initiative, right, it digitized the letter of credit, and it was one of the last ones standing. It had bought WeTrade's rulebook. It had positioned itself as leading the charge in consolidating trade digitization space. Its shareholders included a whole bunch of major banks and as well as a few non-bank backers. And to stay afloat, it needed to tap them for new funding. Which would have given it an additional 2 years of runway. But this year, sadly, it was unable to do so.
And I mean, what does Contour's closure mean for the wider trade finance landscape? Is the dream of trade digitization over?
Well, the Contour story is really part of a larger emerging trend. So a few years ago, I hate to use this cliched phrase, but it really was all about boiling the ocean, right? Everyone had these big plans to revolutionize the entire landscape. And now what seems to be happening more and more is that banks in particular are kind of moving away from these market-wide transformation initiatives and looking more at going back to basics and creating their own kind of in-house platforms. And this obviously comes because we're in a far less benign macroeconomic environment than before. You know, trade outlook's really gloomy. Banks don't have as much budget as they perhaps once had. And recent conversations that I've had with global trade heads at various banks has sort of indicated that they're taking this more pragmatic approach. So some recent examples are HSBC's Trade Solutions platform. We've also seen Bank of America building out its own digital banking platform. Now, I spoke to Carl Wegner, who's Kontoor's CEO at the time of the news of this story breaking, and he called this approach by banks a mistake. I mean, he said, quote, building things by yourself is never going to work. It's never worked before. The industry needs collaborative projects, particularly at a time when trade is becoming increasingly fragmented, unquote.
Okay, well, it sounds like the outlook's quite grim. Is this the end of the blockchain consortium story for trade?
Who knows, right? There's still some bright spots. The general feeling is that a lot of these initiatives were just simply too early. And some of them are still alive and kicking. The commodity trade finance platform Komgo is one important example. They've got a mix of corporate and financial players on board. Earlier this year, they landed a strategic investment from Santander. So things are going well for them, from what I can see anyway. Kontoor also isn't fully dead and buried, right? There's a lot of value within the network that they've created there. And Kontoor's leadership have said that they're in discussions to explore the potential for someone to come in and manage or take over the network. So like a phoenix, it may yet rise from the ashes.
Okay, well, it sounds like there may or may not be some further development in that particular story in the coming weeks and months ahead. Well, a huge thanks to John, Jacob, Eleanor and Jenny for joining me today for our 2023 GTR News Brief review. And a huge thanks to our listeners. We'll be back in the new year with more coverage of the top stories in trade and trade finance. Thanks for listening.